Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What made John F. Kennedy the man and the leader that he was? Born to great wealth and privilege, Kennedy was raised by a father who expected all of his children to be nothing less than extraordinary. And Joseph Kennedy's second son delivered on that expectation, although his life was marked nearly by as much personal tragedy as political triumph. My guests today tell the story in a new documentary biography of John F. Kennedy that will air as part of a two-part American Experience special on PBS stations, including KERA Channel 13. That happens November 11th and 12th. Susan Bellows directed JFK, and Mark Sammels is executive producer of American Experience. They're in town for a screening and panel discussion related to the upcoming documentary tonight at 7 at Studio Movie Grill. It's wonderful to have both of you here. Welcome.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So what's the first step when you have 4 hours to tell the entire life story of an important figure in American history?
Well, one of the interesting things about the film is that we didn't initially start out assuming it would be 4 hours. I think we made a calculation that there was a certain brevity to his presidential tenure, and so we thought perhaps it should merit a two-hour biography. And it didn't take us long before we got into the story and realized that, in part because of the density of events during his brief 1,000 days in office, and the fact that we actually felt people know very little about the details of his life prior to coming to the Oval Office, that we didn't want to give short shrift to that. So we pretty soon in the process decided that it really needed 4 hours, and we gave it that length. The question of how to tackle that, it was a challenge and, a little daunting to take on such an iconic figure. But in some ways, I entered the story feeling like, as I mentioned earlier, there was a lot that people didn't know about the man. He's a fairly elusive character. And so we were interested in trying to understand as much as we could about the forces that shaped him in his childhood, the real impact of his father, to try and get a deeper understanding of the effects of his health woes, and really sort of have an understanding of how that shaped who he was and how he approached the presidency. Because I think we knew the iconic figure in the White House, but we didn't always really understand what drove the man to say, "Ask not." You know, what was that really about? Who was that man? So
I think that the health issue is really interesting because a lot of people understand that there were times during his presidency when he maybe was not feeling well, but he learned as a boy really to project this image of vitality that it sounds like he almost never actually felt.
I think that's safe to say. I think from early childhood, there was hardly a year that went by in his life when he wasn't grappling with pretty serious health problems, in and out of the hospital constantly. And particularly by his older youth and early adulthood, there was a lot of pain involved with that illness, the issues with his back. And, so he was often, the irony is he's this man of vigor and vitality, but he was in too much pain to pick up his own children or put on his own socks by the time he was an adult. So I think it's a fascinating lens to look at him through, really, because it speaks to both his strength of character, his drive that he had the capacity to push through that much pain, but also his duplicity, because he was not honest about it. Now, he wasn't the first president to sort of obscure his health issues, but he entered office with a disease that was considered fatal. And, while projecting an image of vitality and vigor on the campaign trail, he needed to be followed everywhere by a bag of sort of life support medicines. So there's a fascinating kind of duality there that I think speaks volumes about who he is.
So Kennedy was sort of famously to the manor born. He was wealthy from the moment he was born. His father had great expectations for him. I mean, how much did those expectations feel like a privilege, and how much did they feel like his birthright?
This is actually, just to give you a little bit of context, this is, I think, our 15th or 16th presidential biography, mm-hmm. and there's some recurring themes in presidents. I think what's interesting about the Kennedys is that they, in particular in John F. Kennedy, is that he seems, in a way, to float above the pack, you know, the Lyndon Baines Johnson, for instance, and other politicians who've risen up through the ranks. You have the Kennedys have sort of functioned in some ways as our sort of pseudo-monarchy in a certain way, at least in terms of our imagination. So I think part of what Susan and her team has done really extraordinarily is both to take on the sort of this cloud-like myth of the Kennedys itself, and starting with Joe, who's such a prominent figure in that story, and really peel away and, you know, sort of upend some of the conventional wisdom. You know, the idea that when Jack's older brother died in the war, that it was his father who naturally then tapped him to be, you know, to carry the family's ambitions, which were to the White House. And I think, as the film shows really clearly, Jack was anything but the logical choice to carry that on.
Absolutely. He was extremely ill in the year leading up to Joe's death. He was recovering from his own war injuries and very much on the mend. So there were a lot of people, I mean, within his own family, who didn't really think he had the ability to run for office. And when he certainly – that was a fascinating discovery for me, that we think of him as the man who wrote the playbook on, you know, presidential politics and how to – you know, his presidency is so much about the triumph of personality, really. And it was certainly eye-opening for me to realize just how bad at it that he was early on, that he spoke in a monotone. He didn't really like the process of campaigning and, you know, shaking hands and rubbing shoulders. But he worked hard at it. And he worked so hard at it that I think it reveals a lot about the depth of his own ambition. Yes, you know, his father had ambitions for him, but I think, you know, as we say in the film, the engine that drove him was also his own, I think.
I do think that the relevancy of the – it's more than just sort of curiosity about his health. I think it really says a lot about our media culture that we live in today and how we deal with politicians. I mean, it's long been known that Jack Kennedy – had a number of affairs while he was in the White House. And the common question today is, well, how could that never have gotten out? And it's very much relevant to this, his health situation, which the family just out and out denied that he had a disease that he'd already been diagnosed with. And I think, you know, the answer it is often just more of a simplistic, well, that was then, and, you know, we didn't have that much scrutiny. But, you know, in a way, what we subject politicians to today, when you see it, the alternative reflected in JFK, you really begin to wonder, have we really gained a lot by being 24/7 on multiple platforms, you know, basically just looking at an ultra close-up at politicians and every aspect of their lives? And is it dissuading people from going into office? And you wonder if Jack Kennedy could run for office in 2013 or 14. I don't think so.
Right. I mean, it was surprising to me when we were doing the research and you sort of saw the news articles that did come out on the eve of the Democratic Convention in 1960 in Los Angeles. And they were just a little blip, you know, John Connally announcing that, you know, Jack had Addison's and that they were covering up the state of his health. And it was a headline for a day or two. And then that was that. And they all moved on. And right. It's certainly hard to imagine that would happen today.
It's funny. It occurred to me watching the film, even when people have talked about Chris Christie's potential as a Republican nominee, and everyone says, well, he can't do it because he's too overweight and people will think he's in poor health. I mean, we're in no position to judge this unless we're his personal physician. But it is interesting that everyone today sort of understands that you have to be sort of an ideal specimen to even be considered.
Right. And I think, you know, if you look historically, that was not the case. And there's certainly been some remarkable instances of incapacitation in the White House. You know, Woodrow Wilson probably tops that list, where his wife basically ran the country for almost a year because he was so incapacitated. That's not the story here with Jack. There was never, I don't think, a moment. The film doesn't really, try to establish a moment when he was so incapacitated. It's just more, for me, when I look at the film and I see these iconic home movies of the Kennedys out at Hyannis playing touch football by the sea, mm-hmm. I wince every time Jack throws the ball now because I know what's going on with him.
Well, that's the irony. You know, I think we hold our politicians to such a high standard that they have to be in perfect health because he made that image so impressive and almost a priority. That's kind of the irony that he, you know, coming in after Eisenhower, he was saying, this is how I'll distinguish myself. I'll be the young and vigorous candidate. And it worked for him, but it was a bit of a charade.
So he ran for Congress, campaigned very hard, and then arrived in the House and realized he didn't really enjoy the pedantic details of being a representative.
Yeah, no, I think the quote is he says something like we're worms here. He's a man who hungered to sort of be at the center of the action. And all the day-to-day operations of life in Congress bored him. And so he didn't have any significant accomplishments, and I think fairly soon into his tenure there, he began setting his sights on the Senate, and I think that motivated him. But again, his health, I think, is somewhat of a factor in those early years in Congress because he hadn't been there very long before he received the Addison's diagnosis. I think it was in the spring recess of 47. I mean, I don't even think he'd been in a full year before he received that diagnosis. But it wasn't in his constitution to really enjoy the details of being a congressman much.
So what does it say about him that he didn't really enjoy being a congressman and hadn't had many significant accomplishments and then felt like he ought to be able to run for and win Henry Cabot Lodge's seat?
Well, I would just – Susan knows this much better, but I would just say that actually it's not entirely the case that he had no significant accomplishments up to that point. I mean, at a very young age, he goes abroad and is sort of plunged into pre-war Europe. And his father's the ambassador in London. And he travels and he studies and he writes a pretty influential book.
At age like 21, right? 22?
Yeah, he's still at Harvard and mm-hmm. he's still a student. And, you know, it's very shortly thereafter, his father is actually consulting him about foreign policy. So I think part of his boredom, and aside from the fact that as a junior congressman, you are quite powerless, and I think that's still the case today, and you have to put in your time and work your way up, and he was on a faster track than that. But I also think that he really was just anxious and itching to get involved in a position that had a foreign policy dimension to him. It's, what's equally surprising to me is if the opportunities had not been there, he may have gravitated towards the State House or State Department,
right.
And instead of
yeah, I think one of the most interesting things discoveries for me was when he was in Congress in 1951. You know, he had the privileges of his father's money, but he used it well. Mm-hmm. He took a quite impressive trip traveling to countries that at that time a lot of people wouldn't want to go to. And they were truly it was really fact-finding. It was really wanting to learn more and understand how the world was changing. He was going to countries in Asia and the Middle East that he knew were being impacted by the changing global environment and the collapse of colonialism. And I think he was really trying to understand that. And those were the meaty subjects that kind of interested him. And he was able to start taking action on those when he finally got to the Senate.
Susan Bellows is with us. She directed a new American Experience film called JFK. Mark Sammels is executive producer of PBS's American Experience. They're in town for a screening tonight. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. With more than 40 classes starting in October, from landscape painting to intelligent investing on the Dallas and Plano campuses, smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with director Susan Bellows and executive producer Mark Sammels of PBS's American Experience. Susan is the director of the new film JFK, which will air on PBS stations across the country, including KERA Channel 13, on November 11th and 12th. It's a two-part special. They're in town for a screening and a panel discussion tonight at 7 o'clock at Studio Movie Grill. If you want to attend, tickets are free, but you do have to RSVP. You can learn how at kera.org/think. If you want to join the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So I was about to jump forward to his run for the Democratic nomination, but of course we have to mention the fact that John Kennedy famously married a woman that people are very interested in. How was Jacqueline Bouvier, or Jacqueline, I suppose is how she pronounced it, how was she different than the other women that he had sort of, excuse the expression, run around with before?
I actually think it is Jacqueline, although we always had to go back and forth on that. well, that was a fun thing to sort of discover as well, that I think obviously he has a reputation as being a womanizer, but I think there was a genuine and real attraction there Jacqueline Bouvier. I think she was very different from his sisters, the women that he had grown up with. She was very cultured. She was very interested, not that his sisters weren't, but she, you know, was steeped in European history and art history. She spoke another language. She was extremely refined. And they connected over their sense of humor and sensibility was very similar. They had very different interests. He liked to listen to Frank Sinatra and read James Bond novels. But I think they connected and respected each other in that way. So
she was warned before they were married about his womanizing. How did she take that information?
I think she took it as a challenge. This is sort of what we can piece together from the scholars we worked with. But yes, his best friend, Lem Billings, had kind of warned her that, you know, this is a part of who he is and he's not going to stop. And I think her own background, her father had, you know, been an adulterer. It was a world she'd moved in. I think, you know, I often found myself when I looked at Jack Kennedy's life as a reminder that there was a different benchmark in the 60s. It is sort of that Mad Men era where I'm not saying it was right, but it was there was a cultural understanding that might be a part of the world that you're engaging in. And I think she understood that might be a part of it, but she kind of took it as a challenge.
So, of course, LBJ would ultimately become Kennedy's running mate, but there was no love lost between them during Jack Kennedy's time in the House or the Senate. First of all, talk about their sort of different approaches to getting things done in Washington.
Well, I'll just jump in from the LBJ side. Yeah. I think it's really clear, and certainly this week, I think extremely poignant that, you know, a big part of politics is getting down in the trenches and rolling up your sleeves and really pushing through legislation. And no one has ever been better at that than LBJ. He understood exactly the kind of horse trading that you needed to do to get anything through these two houses that were set up, you know, at the very beginning in our country. Within those houses are then two parties, and within those parties are factions. And how do you get any piece of legislation through that minefield? And LBJ understood how to do that. Jack Kennedy wasn't in Congress long enough, and quite honestly, I don't think really had the patience or really the sort of interest in legislation at that level. Now, later, he's got to find a way to get things through. But I think this was one of the sources of friction between the two. There was, you know, privilege versus the Texas ranch that Johnson liked to conceptualize himself as kind of springing up out of. And so there were a myriad number of differences between the two men that I think was a constant source of friction, particularly for LBJ.
Well, and then certainly going into the campaign of 1960, they were direct competitors and polar opposites in the skill set they brought to campaigning. And Kennedy had spent a number of years leading up to 1960, kind of building his strategic network across the country that would help get him elected. And it kind of blindsided Johnson, who believed that, you know, by that he had earned the nomination. And this was something that, you know, Jack Kennedy was in there kind of changing the game of politics at that point, in the way in which people would get elected to the presidency. And it kind of blindsided Johnson. And, you know, that was also at the root, I think, of their competition.
I was fascinated to learn that Kennedy sort of changed the way the primary competitions happen, and that the way that the parties had selected their nominees before was very different than what we know today.
Yes, I don't think the primaries just didn't play the role in politics that they do today. And he kind of was one of the first people to go out there and begin to realize how to use that to his advantage. And that's significant, quite significant.
I agree with you, Chris. I every one of these films is an opportunity to learn, which mm-hmm. is why they're fun to work on. And I mean, there's a moment in the film where that someone points out who decided to participate in a particular primary. Not all the candidates participated in all the primaries. I mean, that's unthinkable now. I mean, next Tuesday, we'll probably start the primaries for the next presidential.
Yeah, Johnson didn't bother competing in most mm-hmm. of the primaries, and it caught him off guard. He thought he didn't have to.
Of course, there are now, and there were then, a lot of Catholics in this country, but there were great concerns among the sort of white Protestant establishment about electing a Catholic president. We have a little bit of tape of Kennedy's response, but can you set up for us? It's hard to understand in 2013 how that was considered such a dangerous thing.
It is hard. It was surprising. There, a quarter of the American electorate said they would not vote for a Catholic. Right in the, you know, in 58 and 59, when Kennedy was deciding whether or not to run, the issue bothered him and frustrated him. And there were a lot of people within the Democratic Party that thought it was so significant that he shouldn't risk it, that they should wait till this fear of a Catholic, you know, diminished. But he was not a man to wait. And he went ahead with it. But it continued to frustrate him that the issue kept surfacing and people kept asking about it. He tried to he addressed it in the West Virginia primary and gave a significant and important speech there. And I think he thought he'd maybe put it to rest for a bit, but he didn't. And when it went into the general election, the issue continued to dog him.
Well, let's listen. This is when he was speaking at a conference of ministers in Houston.
So it is apparently necessary for me to state once again, not what kind of church I believe in, for that should be important only to me, but what kind of America I believe in. I believe in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute. And this is the kind of America I fought for in the South Pacific, and the kind my brother died for in Europe. No one suggested then that we might have a divided loyalty, that we did not believe in liberty, or that we belonged to a disloyal group that threatened, I quote, the freedoms for which our forefathers died. So I want you to know that I'm grateful to you for inviting me tonight. I'm sure that I have made no converts to my church, but I do hope that at least my view, which I believe to be the view of my fellow Catholics who hold office, I hope that it may be of some value in at least assisting you to make a careful judgment. Thank you.
John Kennedy there speaking to a conference of ministers in Houston when he was running for the presidency. We're speaking with the producer and director of a new American Experience film called JFK, Mark Sammels and Susan Bellows. How Catholic was he?
That's an interesting question. He was not as Catholic as his mother, Rose Kennedy, probably would have liked him to be. Mm-hmm. And I don't think he was as committed and involved in the church and the teachings of the church as his younger brother Bobby was. But, you know, it was certainly a part of his cultural heritage. He had been raised a Catholic. It was, you know, it was a part of who he was. But I think one of the things that strikes me again as I listen to that speech is, you know, it was quite remarkable. A lot of his advisors were telling him he shouldn't go give that speech, that it was just going to the enemy. They were going to tear him apart. It was not a smart thing to do. It was just calling attention to his Catholicism, that it wouldn't serve him. But he was sort of determined to go to, you know, as Kathleen Kennedy Townsend referred to it, into the belly of the beast. And I think it's fascinating. At the end of that clip, you hear the whole audience sort of laugh at his joke. I don't know if I've made any converts, and I just feel like it's sort of his mastery, that he wasn't afraid to go in there and sort of take this high moral stand. And then you get the sense that he's charmed that audience.
I think one of the recurring themes of the film, and really one of the great opportunities to sort of revisit this and look at this again, is how charming he was, how JFK was, and how he used this, his humor, to disarm his enemies. And sometimes it's self-deprecating humor, and sometimes it's just really almost scripted. And time and again, when there's a press conference or interviews where there's a moment of tension, he calls upon this charm, basically. And, you know, that was a tremendous part of what starts to gather around him, you know, to gather up around him, really, this sort of sense of the Kennedy mystique, the Kennedy aura. And you've got his age, he's got his youthfulness, you've got his apparent vigor, and it starts adding and adding. And now you hear these calls for we're going to turn a corner in this country, we're going to start a new era in this country. And the idealism and the inspiration that he starts to develop quite quickly once he gets to the White House is really kind of remarkable to look back on. And you see how it begins with these personality traits.
It was a delicate balance for Kennedy in a time before the Democratic Party sort of shifted demographically to what it is today. He had an interest in civil rights, but he also recognized that there was great political liability potentially in expressing this too much too soon.
Absolutely. He was extremely cautious on civil rights, and you know, one could even say too cautious, and dragged his feet once he was in office. He took a bold step in reaching out to call Coretta King during the campaign, the presidential campaign, and that had a huge impact on the African American community. And, you know, we interviewed Andrew Young in our film, and he spoke about how, well, there were some misgivings and some distrust and a sense that this man of privilege probably didn't understand the experience of most African Americans at that time. It meant a great deal that he had been willing to sort of reach out to the wife of a black man in jail. And so that really turned a corner for him. Politically, I think they had higher expectations for him in office, and you know, were frustrated and pushed against him. I think he belatedly came to the table and in their view, did the right thing, but at political risk. So
I think one of the things the film really points out well is a recurring theme in presidencies, which is intentions versus realities. I think it's pretty clear that Jack Kennedy intended to be a foreign policy president when he came into the White House. That's where his background was. That was his experience. And that, frankly, you know, it's the beginning of the Cold War. The Cold War is really underway. And he thought that his presidency would be dominated by his relationship with the Soviet Union. And what happens? The unforeseen, the civil rights movement really explodes at the beginning of the 60s. And I think they were late. The Kennedys were late, and it was both he and his brother Bobby were late to get on the program with the civil rights movement, because I think they wanted to be looking elsewhere for what they were doing. And this recurs over and over again in presidencies. And I think it's so interesting to remind you that as much as we think we can predict where we're going or where the next couple of years are going to take us, there's always the unforeseen that comes in. And no place does that reach such a, I think, a crisis moment as in the White House.
Let's listen here to a little bit of his inauguration speech.
Let every nation know, whether it wishes us well or ill, that we shall pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe to assure the survival and the success of liberty.
That is certainly an outward-reaching inaugural address. He's not talking to the American people there.
No, he's talking to the world. He's saying, and this is another thing I think that I don't think is so commonly understood, is just how strong he was and with his foreign policy, and how he was really concerned that he would not have the fortitude to go up against the Soviet leaders. And he was determined to project strength and confidence. And I think the film has some remarkable stories about that, the intersection of the Soviets and Jack Kennedy.
Well, in that moment, too, I mean, it's certainly probably one of the most replayed inaugural addresses ever, and particularly the ask not and the inspirational tone, all of which was there. But it's, you know, I think few people realize that the entire speech is really about international policy and about the world. And he's also speaking to, you know, America at that time was a little anxious about the Soviet threat. And he's entering office at a time when our greatest adversary had the capability of sending nuclear missiles, you know, that would strike us. That suddenly was a reality. And that to him was sort of the biggest challenge he faced. And the other thing, you know, that in the speech is he's acknowledging the changing balance of power in the world. And I think that's a fascinating thing to think about, too, that he was, you know, in the early 1960s, we were still the preeminent American nation. But there were a lot of new countries gaining their independence, I think something like 19 seeking membership in the United Nations. And so he was trying to position America in that changing world.
We're speaking this hour with filmmaker Susan Bellows and Mark Sammels, who is executive producer of PBS's American Experience. The American Experience film JFK will air in two parts on PBS stations around the country November 11th and 12th. They're in town for a screening and panel discussion tonight at 7 at Studio Movie Grill. If you'd like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. With more than 40 classes starting in October, from landscape painting to intelligent investing on the Dallas and Plano campuses, smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with director Susan Bellows and executive producer of American Experience, Mark Sammels. They are here for a screening and panel discussion of the new film JFK. That American Experience special will air on PBS stations around the country, including KERA Channel 13, November 11th and 12th. The panel discussion will happen tonight at 7 at Studio Movie Grill. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Would you describe Kennedy as chastened by what happened at the Bay of Pigs?
Yes. It was a colossal failure, and he knew it, and he took a lot of the blame for it. And I think he learned a lot from the experience. He learned how to do a better job of vetting situations and who to trust, who not to trust. And I think it helped strengthen him in ways that made him a better president. But it was a terrible failure, and it was a terrible thing to begin his presidency with.
The treatment here of the Cuban Missile Crisis is really fascinating, and I was telling you both before the show that I learned a lot from that. I was wondering if the fact that Kennedy had that disastrous start in terms of foreign policy and particularly dealing with the Soviet Union and its allies early in his presidency didn't cause him to move more cautiously in ways that might very well have saved us from something that could have been catastrophic.
I think it did. I think he's was cautious by nature. But in the case of the Cuban Missile Crisis, his cautiousness was a good thing. He held back the hawks in the room. He waited and allowed time for cooler temperaments to emerge. And he was more distrustful of the advice of military advisors than he perhaps might have been had he not gone through the trials of the Bay of Pigs.
I think one of the things the film points out really well is that after Bay of Pigs and before the missile crisis, in some ways, Jack Kennedy replicates his family in the White House. He's got, for the first time ever, he's got his brother in a high position in the administration. And as you say in the film over and again, in these key moments, he pulls tighter and tighter his circle of trust, and sometimes centering just on Bobby Kennedy. And I think what the counterpart to that also is that he starts to assume a more and more confident role as the commander-in-chief.
Yes. Yeah, he is. I mean, I think universally people kind of praise the command that he held during the Cuban Missile Crisis for 13 days, being able to keep differing opinions at bay and still keep his eye on needing to keep a dialogue open with Khrushchev and stand in Khrushchev's shoes and understand the pressures that he might be under and when he could trust the information coming to him from the Soviet Union and when he couldn't. And I think he had really become the much more seasoned president and effective by that time.
I think you both must have particular insight on this, having worked on a number of these over the years, looked at different presidents and presidencies. This is a job that we expect whoever is in the White House to know exactly what they're doing on day one. And it seems that every job has a learning curve. Is there a predictable pattern by which successful presidents get up to speed?
Wow, that's a really interesting question. I think the one thing, Chris, that we hear over and over again in our presidential biographies is that nothing, absolutely nothing, can prepare you for day one as president of the United States. That is, as much as you have anticipated what it must be like, even if you've dealt with presidents from your congressional seat, the weight of that job is so enormous. And this, you know, really in 1960, America has just come out not that far in the past, has won World War II, and has really had this decade of rapid economic growth. We are asserting ourselves across the world. And the eyes of the world are starting to turn to America for leadership. So it's a position not only of leading this vast nation, but now leading the world community. And Jack Kennedy really just sort of plopped in there, has a disaster on literally his first week, and really has to rise to the occasion. It's a remarkable story about where do you pull those resources together within yourself, within those you trust, within your administration, and how do you rise up from that? And I think that's why it's such a compelling story.
Yeah, in the first year of his presidency, first, you could almost argue even the first 18 months were a trial. He was not gaining traction on any of his initiatives. He had the failure of the Bay of Pigs. He'd had a bit of a debacle in Vienna at in a conference with Khrushchev. So I think that's the calculation too, that it's hard not to be impressed that he'd learned through that failure.
And the film really isn't a hagiography. It's not a whitewashed film. I mean, it really points out that these problems are of his own making,
right,
in many cases. And I think we want to look at it not through sort of the misty lens of his martyrdom, but really look at it going forward in time and look at his presidency really with a cold new eye and give him his due when the accomplishments are significant and also take him to task when his inexperience or his arrogance or his, you know,
failure
the fact
to keep
that,
his eye on the ball,
yeah, or just, you know, his inability to really have a large trusted group of aides with a lot of expertise. I mean, sometimes he was making hunch guesses.
Right. How did he take in and process information when he had a major decision to make?
You know, the lore is that he was a speed reader and that, you know, he absorbed information well. But he liked to, I think, perhaps like a lot of presidents, he liked to listen to all the different viewpoints, and then he wanted to make the decision. He liked to hear competing viewpoints, but he was the ultimate arbiter.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here from Fred who wants to know, what was the influence of the Dulles brothers on JFK?
Huh, that's an interesting question. Well, John Foster wasn't really a part of his administration, but Allen was still head of the CIA. Mm-hmm. And he kept him on, I think, for continuity. He kept on, you know, when he entered office, he established a sort of bipartisan administration. And in part, some theories are that he didn't feel that strongly about, you know, his narrow margin of victory sort of required it. But Dulles didn't last long. He ended up being ousted after the Bay of Pigs. So I don't know what that says about their relationship.
Is it safe to say that Kennedy had indeed hit his stride by the time he was killed?
It does feel that way. And, you know, like so many things, it's hard not to have the assassination color everything about Kennedy.
Right.
And so it's hard not to feel like, ah, oh, he was cut short just as he was finally hitting his stride. I mean, there were a lot of challenges ahead for him. There's no question. But I think after the Cuban Missile Crisis, I think he had a real sense of accomplishment, and he also knew what he wanted to do with that renewed sense of power and authority that he'd gained through that trial. And so I think he was feeling, he was feeling happy about the nuclear test ban treaty and that success that had been incredibly important to him. There's indications that he was in a better place in his life personally, that his marriage with Jackie was in a better place. But there were still a lot of challenges ahead for him, whether the Civil Rights Bill was going to pass, what the heck was going to go on in Vietnam. We make a point of not taking on all those what ifs. But I think it's hard not to feel at the end of his life that he was feeling a little bit more in command of his powers and the office.
I don't know exactly how to feel about Joe Kennedy Sr., but I will say I was touched by the ongoing importance of his influence in Jack Kennedy's life, even beyond the point that Joseph Kennedy was even really able to communicate.
Yeah, he had a profound influence, a driving force in I think all of his kids' lives. But he was a sounding board. He certainly enabled Jack's political career through by bankrolling it, but beyond that, beyond all the doors he opened up for Jack to allow him to enter into politics and supporting him in that endeavor, I think he just relied on him. Jack relied on Joe as an advisor, as a counselor, as a sounding board. I mean, I was struck when we were doing the film how many times there was this sense of, let's call Dad, he'll make us feel
right.
better. And these are grown men
leading the free world. Yeah.
Exactly, call Dad, he'll make you feel better.
Another example of that, the White House, the Kennedy White House, really is the Kennedy family,
right,
in a way.
Mm-hmm. Right, and so I think. You know, it was a profound loss for him.
Can you speak a little bit about the process of going through essentially 40-some years of film and videotape of someone's life and finding the best images and making sure they're clear because that stuff starts to degrade over time? What's that process like? And are there, you know, 95 interns and assistant producers who are assigned to cull through all that?
It was smooth and easy.
We could have used 95 interns, but we really didn't have that many. It was overwhelming at times, mm-hmm. Because there is such a volume, an endless amount of material on Kennedy. I think one thing that struck me, having worked, you know, most of my life in film, that this was probably the first thing I ever worked on where so much of it is now online, the amount that we could do, the amount of research we could do online. And that was both a blessing and a curse, because through all the social media sites and with someone like Jack, people have created so many pages and posted so many images. And you know, we would find images on Tumblr or this. And where did they get that? Where is that from? You know, all these uncredited, unsourced things. So it was, that was a huge production challenge. But we benefited in part because we had a archive within our public television station, because years ago we had produced a film on the Kennedys, and that helped lead us to a trail of some footage that I think might have been difficult to find otherwise. You know, there's some wonderful footage in there we found of him campaigning in the Senate, and you know, I think that was rescued from a trash bin by somebody who'd worked at the advertising agency that had helped produce those for him. So we have all these outs in the film. But it was overwhelming to the production team because, you know, not a day went by where you would discover something. It's like, wow, I haven't seen that one. You know?
And this is really recent history, Chris. I mean, the screening tonight is going to be the first time that any portion of the film has been screened publicly. So we wanted to bring it here to Dallas appropriately in the 50th anniversary of the assassination. But, you know, I would say that, you know, there was both a surplus and then, you know, interestingly enough, at the 5 minutes to midnight in the course of making this film, you were still waiting for footage from Ireland, footage from Czechoslovakia, for those specific things that you really need. So there's still, in a way, in a digital world, there's still this very analog thing that you got to get someone to go down and pull it and make it available to you.
Absolutely. Right. It was like you had the tools to sort of identify that something was out there, but then you'd find the shot that you needed actually hadn't been digitized, or the networks had put it on their YouTube channel, but they had no idea where the actual film was.
Right.
So it's an interesting world we live in now.
Was there anything you just felt incredibly lucky to have? Did you stumble across anything?
I think the footage I was mentioning to you,
this congressional campaign
stuff, where you get to sort of see the young Jack, who's the political work in progress. I think that was wonderful to find, and you know, just early images of him that I think I'd never seen before. I think the later Jack was more familiar to us, but some of the early childhood pictures were kind of interesting to me.
Susan Bellows is the director of the new American Experience documentary biography, JFK. Mark Sammels is executive producer of American Experience. They're in town for a screening tonight at Studio Movie Grill. You can find information about that appearance on the Think page of KERA.org. You can see the documentary in its entirety on November 11th and 12th on KERA Channel 13 television. Susan and Mark, it's been wonderful to have you both. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. We had help on the phones today from Christina Martinez. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer, and Christine McConnell produces our podcast. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.